Are we supposed to get married?
I'm going
to
just swipe
I just want somebody to share my life with.
Lock your relationships down now, because a second lockdown is on the horizon, huh?
You can keep waiting for the fairy tale, or you can get on board with the new rules of relationships. If you've read my advice in the LA Times, then you know this ain't your mama's love advice. This is Dates and Mates with Damona Hoffman.
Hello, lovers. We are recording this on what I think is day four of the election saga. And it's been a tumultuous day already. Well, a tumultuous week, actually month. Well, let's be real, year. You get the picture. But the Dates and Mates train, it has to keep on trucking because people still need help in love. And I'm reading the room, y'all. The other day when I finished my coaching call for my women's group program, I realized there's a lot of anxious energy, not just in dating, but overall. So today, I thought it'd be a welcome departure to hear some love stories from a more romantic era with Francesca Bowman, historian and author. Get this, Francesca has found personal ads from various newspapers over the last couple hundred years that were written by people looking for marriage. And she's compiled them all into the delightful new book, Matrimony, Inc. So today we're going to explore how the search for love throughout history has built the foundation for dating today. And I'm so excited for y'all to hear this interview and have a little fun with us and a little levity and bask in the fantasy with me and Francesca. But first, as always, we have headlines. Lock your relationships down now, because a second lockdown is on the horizon, huh? And relationship anarchy, the latest movement shaping the future of love. Plus, the photos you should put on your dating profile today. Not. Sorry, I just watched the Borat subsequent movie film. So funny, I had to call that one back. All right, why don't we get on with it, and let's dish.
D's Dating Dish.
Bustle reported the new rules for dating in a second lockdown. So I know we have people from all over the US, from Canada, from the UK. And I just found out that our friends in the UK, as of today, the day that we're recording this, they are facing a second lockdown. And the writing is on the wall, folks. It ain't going so hot in many other places. So there's a really good chance that lockdown can be coming your way again. So number one, get your roots taken care of. That's what I'll be doing. Getting my little haircut done, getting my roots done. Get yourself put together, because we could be in this for a while. That aside, okay, do what you want. If you don't feel like doing all that and getting yourself gussied up, that's fine. But you should know how it's going to affect dating in the future. Because remember this anxiety that I was talking about at the beginning of the show? Well, that is increasing as we are approaching cuffing season, and the options for virtual for social distance dates are going to be dwindling. So I suggest let's get comfortable again with the virtual Zoom video chat dates. Maybe you could have an activity, watch a movie together, but over video chat. Figure out some ways that you can still connect and feel together, even if you have to do it apart. And maybe you should be thinking at this point about a support bubble. I think none of us could really have anticipated what was coming back in the spring. And it's a wise idea for you to broaden out your social circle. This may be with a partner. This may be also with a F buddy. Maybe you didn't cuff yet, but look, we still have needs. So maybe you have an agreement with somebody that's in your circle so you can still get your needs met during the winter months. The UK government says sleepovers aren't allowed. And so this is something that we're going to have to learn how to work around. So it's decision time for some of you. And for others, it may be a time for expansion in figuring out how to date in a new way. There was a super interesting article in Self this week about relationship anarchy. I had never heard of this phrase before, but basically what it means is putting less emphasis on titles of different people in your life, like partner, sibling, parent, friend, and also putting less emphasis on your relationship significance. I would say relationship anarchy, it sounds kind of dramatic. And believe me, there was a lot of, there's high drama in this article, but I really love at the core the message that it's giving us. Like they cited that you're expected to prioritize your mother just because she's your mother, or your romantic partner, you are supposed to live with them because they're your romantic partner. But what if? What if it looked different? You know, we were just talking about bubbles. What if you live with your platonic partner, but your romantic partner is someone that you see now more like the way in the frequency that you see a friend? And I've been actually talking about something similar to this for a while, in not making your partner the center of your world. I think that's really dangerous when you're expecting your partner to deliver everything to you. They're supposed to be your confidant, your activity partner, your romantic partner, your co-housekeeper. And that puts a lot of pressure on one person to fulfill all your needs. So I've always said, make sure you keep investing in the other relationships. And I remember situations with friends that would always get sucked into that black hole of relationships. I think you know what I'm talking about. And then they forget all of the other friendships. They give everything to that partner. And then when a breakup comes, here they come crawling back like you're my best friend again. And I think there is something to be said for relationship anarchy and the points that this person makes in this article, that it's a reminder you can choose how much time you give to people. You can choose the focus that you give to people. Obviously, you want to be on the same page with your romantic partner so they feel they're getting their needs met as well. But let's not, especially in a time like this, let's not minimize your relationships with your friends and your family. And in the article, they're talking about maybe getting rid of labels altogether. I don't know if you want to go that far with it, but I think it's the right time for you to maybe reexamine how much focus you put on finding that romantic partner and the role that you're looking for them to fill in your life, and take stock of what you already have and the people you already have that are bringing you love right now. Inside Hook shared the photos that men should never put in a dating profile. A lot of these were standard, and a lot of these I've said for a long time. I have them in my book, like, hello, no excessive group pics. I would say actually no group pics. I always say you have to be the star of your profile. We don't want anyone else distracting the focus from you, because I know, like, when I'm swiping for clients, I'm looking at you and your friends, and I can't tell which one you are. And what if your friend is more attractive than you are? Then you don't want to set yourself up for that. You don't want to have somebody's phantom arm strangely cropped out of your photo. I see this a lot, the phantom hair. I can still tell, and I'm still making determinations. Like, if I see random blonde hair hanging over your shoulder and my client is brunette, I'm thinking, well, maybe this is not a fit. And you just don't want to place that moment of questioning in someone's mind when they're going through making split second decisions. Most women, it takes 7 seconds for them to make a decision about a profile. For men, it's only 5 or less. So you really have to lead with your best foot forward on your dating profile if you're wanting to make a connection. Some other things to avoid, according to Inside Hook. They said selfies. I really want to know what you all think of this. I have come around to selfies being a normal and acceptable part of a dating profile. But they were saying bad selfies are almost less bad than good selfies, because good selfies can be deceitfully flattering. But I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Who's running around with like a photo shoot, a photographer following them around taking their dating profile photos? That surprised me. I'm still in favor of the selfies. Just make sure that they're taken with good lighting at an appropriate angle and not in the bed, according to this article. No bed selfies. That's not something I see a lot. Maybe you're on different apps than my clients, but I'm not seeing too many bed selfies, but definitely no gym mirror selfies. This is a rampant issue in dating profiles, the gym mirror selfies. While we're at it, just no mirror selfies. And also, this is really interesting, they said no shirtless pics. Dating.com did a little study on this and said that straight men who included shirtless photos of themselves in their dating profiles tended to perform far worse on online dating platforms and got 25% fewer matches than their fully clothed counterparts. We like the abs. Just let us work for them a little bit more. Leave something to the imagination. All right, that's the headlines for this week. In a moment, we will be back with author Francesca Bowman and a deep dive into the history of dating profiles and what you can learn from them today. We are back, and I am here with someone who has one of the most interesting bylines I have ever read. Francesca Bowman is a former TV host, historian, and part-time bookseller. She is also the author of 6 books, including A History of the Pineapple and A History of British Personal Ads. Francesca Bowman's latest deep dive into history is Matrimony, Inc., From Personal Ads to Swiping Right, A Story of America Looking for Love. I'm so excited to introduce her here on Dates and Mates to you. Please help me give big smooches to Francesca Bowman.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I am so excited about this book, Matrimony, Inc., because, well, I mean, I'll just say the subtitle, From Personal Ads to Swiping Right, A Story of America Looking for Love. It so resonated for me as someone who found love online and now on the show coaches so many people to be able to use the tools of dating apps to find love. The parallels were obviously glaringly obvious.
So many parallels, yeah.
I just want to begin, first of all, I know you're a book person. Where did you get the idea for Matrimony?
Well, I have always been interested in personal ads, right? I've always kind of read them, you know, years ago when they'd be in the back of the newspaper or magazines, I'd always trawl through them because there is something so amazing about these kind of tiny little detective stories, right? Just a few hundred words and there's somebody's whole life in some ways, you know, there in the newspaper. I can remember some of my favorites like, Woman who likes pasta seeks man who likes sauce. You know, these very like concise, cute little personal ads. And then one day on a whim, I started looking into them and I found they dated back much, much further than anybody ever knew. And after just like a few weeks trawling through old American newspapers, I found America's earliest personal ads, which no one knew existed. No one knew how far back it goes. But I found America's first ever personal ad, which was from the Boston Evening Post in 1759. So really a long time ago. And once I found that, I realized that there was an amazing story to be told here, right? Because all these personal ads that then, you know, became computer dating and then obviously dating websites and now dating apps, they give you so much evidence over 250 years about the history of our emotions, our desires, and most importantly, the history of mate choice, right? What men look for in a woman and women look for in a man, and how that's changed, well, or I'm afraid often not changed over the past 250 years.
Okay. You have said so much and I'm just like, I don't even know where to begin
so
with this.
So many questions.
First of all, 1759, what does an ad from that era look like?
Right. Great question. So I spend weeks and months trawling through old newspapers in libraries, basements of libraries all over America. And the Boston Evening Post was one of America's earliest newspapers. And then one day, there it is, like on the front page of the newspaper. And it was, February the 23rd, 1759. And what's amazing is it gives you such an insight into what a guy in Boston looked for in a woman then, right? So this is what he was looking for. Any young lady between the age of 18 and 23, of a middling stature, brown hair, regular features, and with a lively, brisk eye, of good morals, So that's like the starting point. He then goes on to say, must be possessed of £300 or £400 entirely at her disposal. So there's all kinds of interesting things in there. Like, right, he's looking for a woman between 18 and 23. So, you know, really young by our standards today. But at the time, the average age for a woman to marry was 22 and a half. So between 18 and 23.
But he was trying to catch him young.
Trying to catch him young and fertile at the time. Young and fertile, I'm afraid. I love the way he says of middling stature and brown hair. Like, what does he have against blondes back then in 1759? He's very specific that he wants a woman with brown hair, regular features, good morals, of course, very important to be respectable at the time, and then £300 or £400. And so if you take that all together, basically what this Boston gentleman is looking for is a woman who is young, respectable, and rich.
That's what anyone would want, of course.
I mean, certainly there is some consistency in terms of what people look for.
So based on what I hear now from people who are tentative about dating apps and online dating, why would a guy in that era turn to a newspaper to find his match?
So for almost exactly the same reasons as people do today. And we can see that in the evidence when you start getting hundreds of thousands of personal ads, again, that no one really knew exist until I researched them. They really took off in Philadelphia in the 1840s. And in those ads, lots of the men are very specific about why they're placing these ads, right? And it basically comes down to they're new in town, they work long hours, they don't have time to meet people. Sometimes it's because they're kind of shy. You know, sound familiar? Like, it's all the same reasons as people do today, really. And why it happens is with urbanization and industrialization, right? So once these cities grew, once the population of Boston hit 20,000, New York 30,000, Philadelphia 50,000, you can't any longer rely on like your mum to match you up, or, you know, your church to match you up, or your friend or your neighbor next door to match you up, which is how it would have been done in the olden days. If you're moving to the big city, you're getting a new job, as people were in the 18th century, you've got to kind of turn to some new forms of matchmaking. And so, you know, because people were kind of tentative about this, they will explain in their ads that, like, they'll say, oh, I'm a stranger in the city. Or one guy says, he talks about himself in the third person. He says, of a rather a bashful, retiring disposition, which has hitherto prevented him from mixing much in female company. So he's shy. Fair enough. We all understand that. Another guy says,
he's a wordsmith too. So, I mean,
they all are.
That's a snatch that right. One up. That,
exactly. They all are such wordsmiths. And that's, you know, what's so wonderful about many of these ads. Another guy says, being closely confined by his business, he cannot devote the time necessary to a protracted courtship. He therefore avails himself of the medium of a publication to express his wishes. So that guy's just in a hurry, like works really long hours and he's in a hurry. So, you know, what one of my favorite things about researching this was how relatable all these people are. You know, they're advertising for a lot of the same reasons that people are today, right? Work really long hours. Who has time to meet people? Maybe they've moved to like a different part of the country, so they're far away from like their college friends or whatever, or, you know, their mom. Or so it's really the same reasons as today.
Well, and our listeners have heard me say before that online dating now is the predominant way that people are meeting, more than all of the other methods you mentioned, through friends, through family, through church.
Yeah, for
and,
sure.
And even though some people aren't ready to embrace it, I feel like the interpretation of dating apps, the reputation of dating apps has shifted a little bit. But even just going back, I've also talked about on the show before how even a few generations ago, most people met and married someone who lived in their own hometown. They lived within 5 miles of their house, according to records even back in the 1940s or the 1920s. Right. So you're going even further back. There must have been some sort of a feeling in the 1840s, if you had to go to a newspaper to find love, did that have a stigma around it?
Do Do you know, not as much as you might think when it first started. I mean, some of the advertisers do, you know, you say things like, oh, secrecy assured, or no triflers need apply, you know, to show that they were serious and genuine about this. But like you say, there was a real need for it. And it in some ways became a public service, you know, like a postal system, right? Because if you couldn't just marry the girl next door, or, you know, the boy you went to school with, and people couldn't, not just because of urbanization, but increasingly in the 19th century, with the settling of the West, right? In some parts of the American West, there was such a gender disparity. There was, you know, like in Iowa, there was 3 men for every 1 woman. In California, during the gold rush, there were 250 men for every 1 woman, right? And so then, right, then it's just a question of need. And therefore, as a result, there isn't necessarily the stigma surrounding it that you might think. When the stigma emerged, really, was after the peak of personal ads, of advertising for love in the 1860s, 1870s, when there were so many hundreds and thousands of these personal ads in every state in the nation, every local newspaper from Kansas to Wisconsin, Wyoming, North Dakota. Every local newspaper had personal ads saying wife wanted or husband wanted through the 1870s, 1880s. When the stigma came was actually around the turn of that century, around 1900, 1910, when there was a huge crime wave that was reported around the personal ads. It's not necessarily that it was the first crime wave, but the first crime wave that was reported with the rise of newspapers, and newspapers who liked to scandal, right? So they didn't report stories of people who met through a personal ad and lived happily ever after, because that's not interesting to anybody, right? They sadly reported stories of, you know, when there was like a crime, like fraud or bigamy or even murder. And there were a lot of those, you know, particularly in the New York Times around 1900, 1910. And that's what really gave advertising for love its kind of bad rap for a long time. It meant people thought it was like scary or worrying, or, you know, that it would cause problems, that it was dangerous. And that was a kind of early 20th century thing, really. So it came in, actually, the stigma surrounding it emerged much later than you might think.
See, that so resonates. I'm always saying that we hear these stories because they're rare, or because, like you said, they make a good salacious story. They sell newspapers. They get you to watch the television show.
Exactly.
It's not, you don't hear the mundane stories because they're not as
entertaining. It's not as entertaining to people if they're like, oh yeah, we met, we fell in love, and we lived happily ever after. Then everyone's like, oh, boring. You know, they want to hear the like salacious, scandalous stories. You don't hear the kind of stable, happy, delightful, loving stories, right? Because that, you know, human nature doesn't sadly respond to those in the same way.
But I've seen that you have some positive stories in your book.
So and many.
You
so
share
many.
Them on your Instagram.
Right.
Tell me some of the good stories, because we love a good rom-com as well. There must have been some positive.
Oh, there were so many positive stories. Hundreds and hundreds of them. And you know, many of your listeners will probably have grandparents or great-grandparents who met through a personal ad. They maybe just don't know about it. But people, you know, would write to me and say, oh, my great-grandmother met her husband through a personal ad. So, for example, one of my favorite stories is about a woman named Augusta Larsson, who was a Swedish immigrant. And in 1892, she answered a personal ad that had been placed in a Chicago-based newspaper where she lived. It was from a guy called Ol Rud, who was from Norway originally and had settled in Washington State, where he farmed the land. He was really a pioneer there. There were hardly any women. And to speak to your point of why did people advertise, like, what else was he supposed to do, right? There were hardly any women around. So it was really smart and sensible to put an ad in a newspaper, you know, in one of the big cities. Augusta Larsson saw this personal ad. They wrote to each other for a few months. And then she, amazingly, decided that her best bet was to travel 2,000 miles to go meet him. So she got the train, and then she got the coach, and then she turned up in this tiny town in Washington State. But they met and they married and they had kids and they farmed the land. You know, places like Washington State would not exist without these kind of pioneers, right? You need them to, you know, build families and to build a nation. And in that way, personal ads, all forms of advertising for love, were really central to the to the founding of America in that way, because without them, these couples, you know, wouldn't have met. So that's one of my favorite stories because it really speaks to, you know, the history of modern America in so many ways.
I love that. I'm always telling my children, I'm like, 100 years ago, y'all would be here to just till the fields. Take your dish to the sink so you don't have to go out and shuck some corn or whatever.
Right. Exactly. So much is different, but then so much stays the same. And I mean, that also speaks to the number of women who advertised in newspapers, like in the 18th and 19th century. So many more women than you might think put personal ads in newspapers. And you'll see them in national newspapers, local newspapers. They have this headline that says, "Husband Wanted," in kind of bold black type. And they really are amazing. Some are very different to what you might read like on a Tinder profile today. And some are kind of the same. So can I read you one of them?
Oh, yes. Yes. And then I want to talk about communication, because you also got me thinking with the love letters. But I want to hear one more and then we can talk.
Okay. So tell me if this is the kind of thing you might read on a Tinder profile today. This was an ad placed by a woman in Wisconsin in 1855. She talks about herself a little and then she describes what she's looking for in a guy. She says, "I want no brainless dandy or foppish fool, but a practical man who can drive a coach or rock the cradle, hoe the garden or attend the ballroom. On the whole, he must dress neat, look well, and keep his head up in society."
That's all I hear, Francesca. All I hear now. They want a man's man.
Right. Look.
Don't hate on. What did she say? Foppish.
She says no foppish. No brainless dandy or foppish fool.
That's funny. It's amazing to me how similar some of these patterns are. But when you brought up the love story and you mentioned how they wrote to each other for a while, that's the part that I feel nostalgic for. And I feel like that's the thing that's changed. Like, people want to blame dating apps for the dissolution of courtship. But I really think it's more communication and the way that we talk to one another and the way that we build relationships that has changed so much, even just in the last 10 years. So they would connect and then they'd send letters back and forth where they could really get to know one another.
Right,
it wasn't just like, "Hey, Netflix and chill."
Right, exactly. And then, and what it does is it builds a friendship, right, from the very beginning. It builds a friendship through this letter writing. I would say, I mean, I'd be interested to know what you think about this. It does seem to me that is one positive spin of the pandemic, right? Is that because people are not able to meet up on a first date in the way that they used to, maybe they're having to communicate in other ways, you know, on Zoom or whatever it is, it creates more space to build a friendship in the same way you might have done if you were a seamstress in Iowa in 1870 and you were writing letters to a gold miner in California back and forth and back and forth for weeks and months. You build a relationship, you build a friendship before you're actually meeting. And I do wonder if that's to be optimistic about right now when dating in a pandemic obviously has so many challenges, that what the one upside is it does give you this space to build a friendship before anything else happens. And surely that could be a wonderful thing.
I really want people to hear and process what you just said, because that is the opportunity that we have right now. And I think that's where we were maybe 3 months ago. Unfortunately, what I'm seeing right now, and I'm not going to call any of you out at this very moment, but I'm seeing actually there's a little bit of panic setting in over cuffing season. Like, everybody's trying to partner up before things get cold. And the fatigue, just the pandemic fatigue of not being around people for so long, is causing people to do really crazy things.
Right.
And just like, well, you know what? It's fine. We'll just make out. It's fine.
Right.
I'm sure it will be fine. And I have always said slow love is the way to go. Just like you were saying, taking the time to build that connection. It doesn't mean that you have to be like writing letters across the miles, but just taking some time first to get to know each other before you build the intimacy and before you like rush into bubbling with someone.
To build a friendship, to become friends, because that's what's going to see you through the tough times. As we all know, it's the friendship that means that relationships can then last 20 or 30 or 50 years. It's the friendship that's at the core of it.
Well, and you're a happily married lady, so I would take advice from you.
I mean, don't take any advice from me.
How did you and your husband meet?
So we met, I used to be a TV host, like 100 years ago. I used to be a TV host on British TV. And he was a TV director and he directed a show that I was hosting, but it was the first one I'd ever done in a TV studio. And I was kind of a little bit vague about how microphones work. Like, I'm not an idiot, right? So when I talk about the director, I'd be like, oh, like, I really like him, or should we see if he'll come out for a drink tonight? I would cover my microphone. I'm not a total idiot. But what I didn't realize is that even then the microphone picks it up. So I'd be in this TV studio, you know, in between takes, like with the makeup lady doing, you know, my makeup and somebody doing my hair. And I'd be like chatting to my co-host. And all of this would be broadcast into the entire like gallery that, you know, the vision mixer, and including my husband to me. But, you know, again, at least he knew I liked him from really early on.
I love that. I love that. In a sense, you kind of made the first move, or you
right? But yes, by mistake, I made the first move.
But you let it be known how you feel, because today I feel like so many people are like, I don't want him to know I like him. I'm just going to play it cool. If she knew I was into her, she wouldn't like me back. And I'm just like, enough right. of the pretense. Let's just be real. So
right.
By default, also, you're real.
When a guy really likes you, he really likes you. So, my husband, I mean, I think he was just busy and it hadn't occurred to him. And then we went out for a drink and then like, oh, and then we had to keep it a secret for ages because like, you don't want to be like, you know, having a thing with somebody at work, right? Who does that unless it's serious? So the first few weeks we kind of kept it a secret. And so I'd be like in the makeup chair before the show and he'd have to like come in and be like, how's everyone this morning? Everyone okay? And I'd have to be like,
wink.
Oh. Yeah, exactly. Wink, wink. So we kept it a secret until we knew it was, you know, pretty serious.
And your husband works in Hollywood, right?
So he's now a movie director. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So he started out working on Borat and with Sacha Baron Cohen, which of course that's very current at the moment. And then he went into movies and, he directed the Muppets movie and Alice Through the Looking Glass with Johnny Depp. And
don't forget Dora.
And Dora.
As a parent, I love Dora. I thought it was so charming. And I didn't even realize that he had directed it. And then when I saw he directed it, I was like, of course. It was
so charming and generous of spirit, exactly. And sweet and funny. And he really makes movies in his own image, I think. Just charming and generous and kind and funny.
Yes. Yes. And so that's interesting. Okay. So your husband, we'll say his name's James Bobbin, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So working in Hollywood, I imagine that's kind of, that impacts the relationship in some way. And my husband is also, he's a TV writer. I rarely talk about what he does. So my listeners might not even know.
Who even knows what the husband does? Nobody. I never do. People say to me, what's James working on? I'm like, oh, I don't really know. We don't talk about things like that.
Right. God. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Like my husband wrote on The Walking Dead for 3 seasons. And oh, cool. I literally maybe saw 2 episodes.
Right.
People are like, I can't believe you're not watching it. But, right. You know, it's interesting when you're in a way in living a relationship in the public eye. And I bring this up because also some of our listeners, even though they might not be able to relate to being in Hollywood, social media does add this element of playing out your relationship publicly. Do you feel like that's ever been an element, you know, especially having been a TV host and now, you know, moving into being an author and having your bookshop, do you think impact your relationship in any way, the public element?
Do you know what? I really don't, to be honest. I really don't. I mean, we've been together 20 years. We met when we were young. And so again, I think there's such a friendship built on that social media is something that we both do for work purposes. But it's social media is very much a work thing for both of us. So it feels pretty separate to our kind of real life, in inverted commas. I mean, obviously there's exceptions to that. But I suppose particularly because what he does is now pretty different to what I do. And, you know, at kind of Hollywood dinner parties, when I say I'm a writer, people of course say, oh, well, you know, what movies did you write? And when I say I'm a historian, people kind of think maybe I'm joking and they're not sure whether to kind of laugh or not. because, you know, it's an unusual job in Hollywood, right?
I get the same thing. When I say I'm a dating coach, people are like, really? Like, right. What is that? Right.
Right. And then, exactly.
And then it becomes the whole conversation, doesn't it?
And then, oh, yes, you can't say it without it becoming a whole thing. You sort of have to take a deep breath and go. And sometimes you find you lie because you can't be bothered to talk about it. Sometimes I want to be like, I'm an accountant, so that then like people don't ask me about it, because I know, you know, once the subject comes up, people will ask me about it.
So what is the topic then when you're at these Hollywood dinner parties? What's the topic that all of the movie stars want to discuss with you?
Okay, I'll tell you what they all want to know. Is what do men look for in a woman and what do women look for in a man? Because I feel like I do have a unique insight into that because I can put the historical perspective on it, right? So there's all the kind of current data or research about mate choice, but I have a uniquely historical perspective of 250 years of what people have looked for and how that's changed.
Well, so give us the goods. Give us the goods.
Well, they'll say, what do men look for? What do women look for? The trouble is, the answer I have to give, because it's the truth, is kind of depressing. So, Because much of mate choice is predicated on evolution, there's always going to be an element of it, right, which is men looking for women who are fertile and women looking for men who can support offspring. I have resources, right? And now that is obviously a huge generalization. And as with every year goes by, there's more and more exceptions to that, of course. And even the definition of that changes. So, you know, women looking for men with resources in the 18th century, that would have meant cash or property. But these days it can mean a good sense of humor or like a lot of Instagram followers or like, you know, really clever at, you know, designing websites or whatever it is. It just means, you know, being able to support offspring if that comes with the relationship. And then the same obviously is women choose not to have children or to have children later. Like obviously, you know, men looking for women who are fertile, that's very, you know, reductive and a huge generalization. But looking at the evidence, because so much of it is about evolution and that's not going to change, if one has to generalize, that's the answer. And I wish it weren't. I wish I could give you a different answer. All I would emphasize is that, of course, there are so many exceptions to that in terms of ages and situations. And with each year that goes by, you get more and more exceptions too. Thank goodness.
I love hearing the historical perspective because I think, you know, we are all a product of our history, right?
Right.
And everything that we've learned from previous generations and everything that is biologically entrenched within our society.
Exactly.
Try to ignore it, but I feel that we have to see it and embrace it. But I think we are at an interesting time, Francesca, because I think we are at this place where our actions have sort of moved beyond our biology. Our society's moved beyond our biology. And we're in this really weird dissonant period where everybody's trying to figure it out.
Right.
And I guess that's what keeps me doing this show for 8 seasons.
Yeah. But makes me help. What is interesting to me is like how quickly are we going to move beyond that entirely? In that, like, why hasn't marriage already died out? You know, we talk about, you know, people, you know, that marriage will have disappeared and done. And yet it kind of seems to like cling on in this weird way. And so I'm interested in a weird way, how slowly things are changing, how slowly dating is changing, how slowly it's changing what people look for in relationships. You know, I would have thought there might've been a more radical shift. And in some strange ways, you know, humans do seem to be oddly kind of conservative with a small C sometimes about the way they form their relationships. I'm waiting for there to be a more radical shift, and I hope it happens, but we'll see.
We will see. Well, I appreciate everything you've shared with us. I think this book, literally, it's fascinating.
Thank
everybody
you.
Run and check out Matrimony Inc. From Personal Ads to Swiping Right, A Story of America Looking for Love. So many more stories than even what Francesca was able to share. And don't forget to follow her on Instagram @Fran's Bookshop. You're a gem, and I'm so glad that you were able to join us on the show and share your insights. Thank you so much
for having me. It's been really fun.
We will, of course, put the link to this amazing book in the show notes. You can get it on Amazon. Matrimony Inc., From Personal Ads to Swiping Right, A Story of America Looking for Love. By the way, I am super excited to announce something new. Damona's Content Club. I will be curating lists of my favorite resources on love. Everything from podcasts to videos to books from prior guests. And you, my friends, you can have access to all that juiciness. All you have to do is become one of my Patreon friends with benefits. For just $5 a month, you can get in the club. You can come to my behind the mic weekly live streams on Facebook. You can get tons of other resources and items from the Dates and Mates library, and you can get into Damona's Content Club. You can find all of that info at patreon.com/datesandmates. And again, it's just $5. $5, support the show and get some more goodies for yourself. patreon.com/datesandmates. This episode is number 335 of Dates and Mates. I would love to hear from you. I am already taking audios and taking questions. I would love for us to connect on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, because I need to know what's on your mind. I need to be answering your questions in love. And I am taking questions right now for our next Dear Damona episode. You can DM me a voice memo of your question. You can message it to me. You can even give me a call. Give me a call, girlfriend, 424-246-6255. Leave it on my voicemail right there. And you could be on a future episode of Dates and Mates and get your love problems solved. So hit me up at Damona Hoffman on all the socials. I will be back again next week with the fabulous Monique Kelly, who's going to talk all about how you can celebrate your singlehood. But until next week, I wish you world peace and happy dating.